Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The Maryland General Assembly has been in session for 2 weeks, and in this unusual year, legislators are acting with unusual speed. Today on Midday, keeping you connected with your state government. WYPR State House reporter Rachel Bay has the latest from Annapolis, from efforts to fight the coronavirus to a potential fight brewing over confirmation of the acting Secretary of Health. Plus, Speaker of the House Adrian Jones has outlined an ambitious black agenda. Three prominent civil rights activists join me with their perspective and priorities for the 2021 session. Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle and the Reverend Kobe Little and Joshua Harris of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP join me after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall. Today on our show, a look at the first 2 weeks of the General Assembly in Annapolis. Given the pandemic and the constitutional requirement that lawmakers be in Annapolis for their deliberations, it's been an unusual session so far, and in some ways, it's progressing at an unusually rapid pace. A focus on racial equity is front and center this year in ways that it's not been in the past. Last August, Senate President Bill Ferguson of Baltimore formed an advisory work group on equity and inclusion, chaired by Senate President Pro Tem Melanie Griffith of Prince George's County, to review bills with an equity lens around issues like health care disparities, economic opportunities, and environmental justice. And last week, Speaker of the House Adrian Jones officially rolled out her black agenda for the session, which includes 9 pieces of legislation and 30 policy recommendations directed at rectifying wealth disparities, improving minority performance and competition for state contracts, and addressing health outcomes for black and brown people. Today on Midday, a status report on what's transpired over the first 2 weeks of the session and conversations with civil rights leaders about their policy priorities. Coming up later, Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle and the president and vice president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP, the Reverend Kobe Little and Joshua Harris, will join me. But we begin today with Rachel Bay of the WYPR news team who covers the State House. Hey, Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what's it like? I mean, last year's session was truncated because of COVID-19. This year, they took various steps to prepare for it. The Senate and the House doing things a little bit differently. Of course, each body, you know, a different number of people that they've got to manage. But what's it like, and what's the first 2 weeks of this session been like compared to others that you've covered?
As you mentioned, it's one of the noticeable things is everything's just going at a faster pace. They've kind of shifted focus. So normally you would see kind of a balance between floor sessions and committee meetings. They seem to be pushing legislation through committees very quickly and much earlier in the session than you normally would see. And then we'll have more floor sessions later on in the session. I believe the idea was to delay the longer and more frequent floor voting sessions, which is when legislators actually vote on bills for final passage, until the COVID infection rates start to go down a little bit post Christmas and what have you. And we're starting to see that now. But for now, they meet in floor sessions in person only a couple of days a week, and usually for less than 2 hours at a time. And then the committees are all meeting virtually over Zoom/YouTube for the rest of us who are not participating in the meetings.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the COVID rates are going down a little bit, at least for the moment, and more and more folks in the legislature are being vaccinated, as those vaccinations become available. But certainly vaccines and the distribution of the vaccines have been high on people's minds. We had a press conference yesterday with Governor Hogan. What did he have to say about that, as well as a hearing that an oversight committee that Bill Ferguson in the Senate has called, where they questioned Dennis Schrader? Tell us about those two events.
Sure. I mean, the big announcement from Hogan's press conference yesterday was really the establishment of these mass vaccination sites. This is not something that we're necessarily going to see right now, because there just aren't enough doses of the vaccine to really get those sites up and running and functioning. But that is something that we can look to for the future. And that really ties into something we heard from the health secretary, the acting health secretary, during this oversight meeting on Monday. This was the first meeting of a committee that the Senate president, Bill Ferguson, has established to provide some oversight to the vaccine rollout process, which legislators have complained repeatedly is not going quickly enough or smoothly enough. And one of the things that acting health secretary Dennis Schrader told lawmakers was that one of the big focuses is to set up the infrastructure to be able to handle a larger number of vaccine doses in the spring and summer when that eventually happens. Legislators have kind of complained that there seems to be a decentralized vaccine distribution effort where you have doses being spread out to lots of different pharmacies and healthcare facilities, rather than really emphasizing the big healthcare institutions, the Johns Hopkins and University of Maryland hospitals around the state and the local health departments, which might be better suited to handle a larger number of vaccinations right now. That's what the legislators would like to see, is this more centralized effort. But the health secretary was saying that if the state were to really centralize the effort now, the state would be setting itself up for struggles when the number of doses the state is getting starts to increase. And so that's kind of the trade-off that's happening right now.
Rachel Bay covers the State House for us here at WIPR as part of our news team. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're talking about the first couple of weeks of the General Assembly, which began 2 weeks ago in Annapolis. So, Rachel, tell us a little bit about Dennis Schrader. He is the acting health secretary. He has been nominated by the governor to become the full-time permanent health secretary. This is not his first time at the rodeo. I mean, there's a history between Mr. Schrader and the Senate, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a bit of a controversial history, a little bit of a political fight here. So several years ago, in 2017, the governor appointed Dennis Schrader to be the health secretary. And there was some dispute in the Senate about whether to confirm Mr. Schrader. And eventually the governor basically decided that he was going to withdraw the nomination rather than have the nomination fail. And then after the session ended that year, the governor reappointed him in the role as a recess appointment, which was not something the legislators were happy about, but they also anticipated that that might happen. So they passed a law saying that he would not be able to get paid if that were to happen, which resulted in a lawsuit. There's kind of a long history that I don't need to get into the details here. But eventually, the governor appointed someone else to be health secretary, Bobby Neal, and Dennis Schrader became the chief operating officer in the health department. So then when Secretary Neal retired a couple of months ago, the governor appointed Dennis Schrader once again to be health secretary. Given that we are in the middle of a pandemic, there seems to be a more pressure on the legislators to allow Dennis Schrader to continue in the role and be confirmed as health secretary. But the Senate president, Bill Ferguson, has made it clear that whether the Senate confirms Schrader is going to hinge on
Schrader's performance leading the vaccine rollout, which so far, as I mentioned, the legislators are really displeased with.
And I'm sure that you'll keep an eye on that for us as that saga unfolds and moves forward. Yesterday, the governor sent five folks to testify about his Relief Act. This is a billion-dollar proposal that he's got to put some money in people's pockets and to exempt them from taxes of various kinds. So that's beginning to wind its way through the legislature. And just this morning, there was a press conference with Senate President Bill Ferguson in which they talk about some proposals as well. What did Mr. Ferguson have to say today?
Yes, it was with the Senate President and also several other Senate leaders. They proposed an amendment to go onto the governor's COVID relief bill. So this would be in addition to the governor's COVID relief bill. The governor's proposal plus this additional proposal would potentially end up running of a little over $1 billion. It's clear that there might be some tweaks to the governor's proposal through the legislative process. So the number may end up changing a little bit. But right now, the legislators have proposed a little over $500,000 to be tacked on to the $750,000, give or take, that the governor's proposal runs. So it would be, $750 million that the governor's proposal runs. So it would be about a $1.2, $1.3 billion COVID relief package total. The overarching idea here is really to kind of fill the gaps in who is not being reached by the governor's COVID proposal. So, for example, one of the big components of the governor's proposal is these stimulus payments that would go to low to moderate income Marylanders, but it would be tied to the earned income tax credit, which does not reach a lot of low income Marylanders. So the Senate has proposed a number of other types of supports, other types of relief payments and things like that. Not the same kind of stimulus payments, but things like food support, disability support, expanded eligibility for unemployment payments, all of these things designed to kind of fill some of those gaps of who's not being reached by the governor's package.
Yeah, and of course, all of this is unfolding in the context of a very nascent political season. Peter Francho, the comptroller, is an early entrant into the race for governor in the next cycle in 2022, and he's got a proposal. And so all of this unfolding as people start looking ahead to a post-Hogan Maryland. You've been working on a story about an immigration bill as well. Tell us what's up with that.
Yeah, and this aired this morning. Maryland, there's a state senator, Shelley Hettleman from Baltimore County, who has proposed a bill that would make Maryland the first state in the country to guarantee the right to an attorney for residents facing deportation. So this is something that, as you may know, that in a criminal case, if you are charged with a crime, you are guaranteed the right to an attorney. If you can't afford one, you are eligible for a public attorney. That's not something that's the case in an immigration case. And so that's something that Senator Hettleman is trying to change with this bill.
There were some harsh words from the governor for the teachers unions in the last couple of press conferences that he's given. There is a fight brewing about whether or not kids should be going back to school for in-person learning. There's also the matter of the governor's veto of the Kerwin Commission bill, that the blueprint for education. It's widely expected that the override that the governor or the veto that the governor put in place last session will be overridden by the legislature this session. You've reported there are 37 bills in all that the governor vetoed, and many of them are going to be overridden. Any sense of the timetable for when the House and Senate will take up the Kerwin education bill in particular?
So the House is scheduled currently to take up some vetoed bill overrides in early February. And the Kerwin bill has to start in the House because it's the House bill that was vetoed. So The House is likely to take that up as early as a couple weeks from now, or maybe next week. I have to look at the calendar. Early February, and then the Senate would take it up after that. The Senate has already overridden a couple of other vetoed bills, some related to crime fighting, violence reduction efforts in Baltimore. But the House has not taken up any vetoes, and obviously it needs to be overridden in both chambers in order for any bill to become law.
Yeah, and in terms of, you know, the COVID relief and the Kerwin education proposals, as they say in the South, we are fixing to spend some money here in the state of Maryland.
Yes.
So we will see how this all plays out. Rachel Bay covers the State House for the WIPR news team and does a terrific job at it, if I may say so myself. Thank you very much. We will be in touch. Okay, take care. Appreciate it, Rachel. Quick break, and when we come back, thoughts on the Black agenda in the General Assembly this year from Davon Love. He's the Director of Public Policy for the advocacy group Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, my guest will be Baltimore County Executive John Olszewski, Jr. We'll talk about the county's COVID-19 vaccination distribution plan and other issues of import to the county. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking Maryland politics. The 2021 General Assembly opened a couple of weeks ago. And joining me now is Davon Love, the Director of Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a social justice advocacy organization based here in Baltimore. Hey, Davon, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man?
I'm doing okay, man. Thank you so much, and thanks for your time today. So as you look to this 2021 session, what's top of mind for you and the folks at Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're focused a lot on policing this session, you know, just given the pandemic, given that the session's going to be mostly virtual. You know, it seems like policing is going to be an item that actually will move this session. And it's really two particular policies around policing that we're focused on. The first is the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, which I'm sure you and your listeners have heard a lot about over the past several months. It's essentially something codified in 1974 that provides protections for law enforcement that undermines the ability for the community to be involved in discipline and oversight. So this includes provisions in it like only sworn law enforcement can participate in the internal investigation of an allegation of misconduct brutality. You know, police officers preside over the disciplinary process and it's codified by law, so it undermines the ability for the community to really participate. And so we're looking to repeal the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, but also replace it with a statewide standard for discipline that still provides police officers that are government employees with due process, because I think one of the things that you'll hear from the other side is that, you know, this is an attempt to strip away due process for law enforcement. As state employees, we want to ensure that there's a statewide standard for due process, but in a way that doesn't undermine the ability for community to be involved in discipline and oversight, and also provide an opportunity for jurisdictions through a local ordinance to establish an oversight body with the ability to dispense discipline and be involved in oversight. So that's the LEOBR. And then the second piece are changes to the Maryland Public Information Act. Currently, the internal investigatory files of law enforcement officers are prohibited from public disclosure. As you and your listeners know, you can make a public information act request and receive information about government agencies. But when it comes to police officers' records, investigatory records, those are prohibited from public disclosure. So we're advocating that those files move from the prohibition from disclosure category to discretionary disclosures, which still allow for agencies to redact information that would they would deem not to be appropriate. And where we are with that piece of legislation is that, you know, there's some tension between what we're looking to do and particularly what House leadership is looking to do. There's a category of investigations or designations of investigations, sustained and unsustained. Sustained meaning that there was an investigation done by the department, they found that there was some basis for that complaint. Unsustained means they found no basis for the complaint. And what we've been able to get from House leadership has been the sustained category, those for which the department felt that there was some cause to take action. What we disagree is that we're advocating us, and there's a statewide coalition on policing that's involved in this as well, is to get the unsustained findings. Those of the department did not deem worthy of taking action. 90% of the complaints that are filed are unsustained. And so if we only get those that are sustained, there's a wide swath, 90% of those other complaints that we won't have access to. And when we look at the Department of Justice, the report from 2016 of Baltimore City's Police Department, or the recently released report that comes out of the Restored Trust in Policing Commission, we see that within those unsustained complaints, that there are examples of misconduct and brutality that if we don't get those files, we will not be able to uncover and potentially prevent an incident of police brutality by being able to track the behavior of law enforcement officers that have a history of having complaints against them.
Davon Love is the Director of Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. If you have a question or a comment about the priorities of LBS in the 2021 General Assembly session, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And to tweet us, it's at @MiddayWYPR. And to follow me on Twitter, it's at @TomHallWYPR. So, Davon, when it comes to a repeal of LEOBAR, the LEOBR, are there paradigms around the country that you look to as a model for what to replace it with? I want to ask you that. And I also want to ask you, do you sense a different dynamic around this issue this year than in years past? Because this year is taking place in the context of the protests that erupted all around the country and the world following the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others, around the country and the world, as I said. So is there a different dynamic this time around? Because repeal of the LEOBR has come up perennially now for the last several years. Do you think there's a different vibe?
So I'll take the second question first. There certainly is, I think, a different environment. I think the social unrest over the past several months as a result of, the killing of Breonna Taylor by law enforcement in Louisville, Kentucky, the death of George Floyd, the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota. I think it just created a social unrest that created an environment where there's more willingness to move on these issues that we have in the past. And I think coupled with the fact that now there's just extensive empirical evidence as to the level of brutality that is maintained as a result of these policies. You know, one of the things that I want to emphasize is that, too often when we think about police brutality, we think about the police killings. But again, when you read these reports, we see that there is all kinds of abuse that's short of police killings. One of the examples I use a lot when I'm testifying in Annapolis that comes out of the DOJ report, there's an incident where an officer over a period of several weeks was just randomly strip searching a gentleman that lived, in that frequented that community. And so there's just all kinds of abuses that are underreported that the general public has not been aware of until very recently. So I think that's created the impetus for the speaker to rightly this summer call for the repeal of the LEOBR, which was big and momentous. In terms of your first question, so as I mentioned, Maryland was the first state to establish a law enforcement officer's bill of rights. And we probably don't have time to go into this, but one of the lead lobbyists for the FOP in the 60s, a gentleman named Benjamin Wolman, was actually an attorney that was found to be involved in hiding some of the activities of the death squads in Prince George's County of the 1960s. And so when we think about, I mentioned that because when you think about the kinds of protections that law enforcement received through the LEOBR, a big part of it is the ability to conceal and not have accountability placed on those that engage in that kind of brutality. And so Maryland is one of now 15 or 16 states that have a law enforcement officer's bill of rights. So we'd be the first to repeal out of those 16 states to repeal it. But again, and incidentally, Minnesota is also another one of those states that have a LEOBR. And so I think we would be on the cutting edge in terms of repealing something that is demonstrably being problematic. If I could make one other point too, Tom, because I think a lot of times when we talk about police misconduct, we talk primarily about the brutality piece, which is important, brutality on the hand of law enforcement. But there's a public safety argument to be made here. Again, I really encourage people to read the report produced by the Restoring Trust and Police Commission. One of the sections, it talks about there were residents that were surveyed in Baltimore. And the residents who surveyed were deemed to have had either neutral or positive beliefs in police officers. One of the things that they identify is that all of them, again, these are people with neutral or positive beliefs in police officers. A majority of them said that they have witnessed police be disrespectful, and a majority of them witnessed police engage in what they thought was excessive force. And what they said was that if they had more transparency, they would be more willing to collaborate with law enforcement. And that's particularly important because when we think about the violence and homicides we see in Baltimore City, a big part of addressing and getting the people who are the drivers of violence is collaboration with the community. So there's a public safety benefit to these police accountability measures as well.
And, you know, coincidentally, just yesterday in federal court here in Baltimore, a former Baltimore police officer, a man named Victor Rivera, who was on the force back in 2009, was convicted of, police misconduct. So this is it's an ongoing issue, to be sure. But is there an agreement about law enforcement rights somewhere in existence in the country that can serve as a paradigm, could serve when you talk about, for example, transparency and a standard to make sure that people's rights, whether they're a police officer or anybody else, are upheld. Is there an example somewhere that you think works, that draws the right balance between the rights of law enforcement and these other values of transparency and making sure that the police officers are not overprotected?
Yeah, one of the issues is that, there's a lot of variance around the country in different states as to different kinds of practices. So for instance, New York just recently repealed a prohibition on the ability to disclose police investigatory records. That was something that just recently happened. And so we'll see the impact that it has. I'm familiar with in New Orleans, for instance, which is where Police Commissioner Harrison comes from. They, to my knowledge, have a civilian review board structure where they're able to track the record of complaints of law enforcement that have been complained, that have complaints against them that come through that civilian review board. So there are a myriad of different things around the country that address different pieces of it. Maryland would be cutting edge in essentially bringing together a lot of what is happening in states around the country to try to develop a process that addresses all of the different pieces. And it's very complex, and so I think, again, we're hoping that this can serve as a model around the country, taking the best of what we think is being tried around the country and some of the major reports that have been done. One other dynamic I also think is important to mention to your question is that, there have been studies on best practices on these issues, in a variety of different contexts. And I've read several federal, former President Obama's 21st Century Report on Policing. The DOJ has released reports over many years, and many of them make recommendations that are very similar to the proposals that we're pushing forward that I've mentioned here on the show today. So we're borrowing from a lot of different, both federal government reports and policies from other states. And again, we hope that this can be as comprehensive as there is in the country.
In our last few minutes here, let's switch topics to taxing recreational cannabis. You say that this should be done with an eye on reparations, identifying the folks who have been, the main focus of the so-called war on drugs. What's the status of that legislation, and what do you think should happen?
It's our understanding that there's, a group of legislators in the House and a group of legislators in the Senate that are putting together proposals around recreational cannabis. the issue of the tax, LBS's proposal over the years has been about the taxation of those revenues and those revenues going back to the communities most directly impacted by the war on drugs. I don't think it's likely that that bill will move this session, just given the pandemic, the constraints, and there's still a lot to be worked out. I think there's a lot of general dissatisfaction, particularly on the part of Black folks in the state of Maryland, as to the resources that are going to be made available and the profits that would be made available to Black folks. And what I mean by that is that, you know, in order to participate in the business of, you know, dispensaries and the like are very capital intensive. And there haven't been really enough efforts to make sure that Black folks are participating in the industry in a way that actually is commensurate with the damage that's been done to Black folks. And so LBS's advocacy has been around looking at the tax revenues as a surefire source of revenue, because if the business is legalized, the recreation is legalized, it will be taxed. And our hope is that at the very least, right, if Black folks are not able to participate on the business side to the extent that's commensurate with the damage that's been done to our communities, at the very least, that it would be taxed in a way where those resources go directly back to the communities that have been impacted by the war on drugs. But again, I don't think it's likely to move this session, just given just all the things that are priorities and just how much left there is, I think, to iron out in terms of the details as to how that would actually happen.
Sure. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Speaker Adrian Jones has outlined, you know, a very comprehensive Black agenda for the legislation, 9 pieces of legislation, 30 policy recommendations. You wrote a piece in Maryland Matters last week about your dissatisfaction with the fact that Luke Klippinger is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He's been the chair for a few years now. Why do you oppose Delegate Klippinger in that position, at which, by the way, seems like he's quite secure? He's not going to be moved from there. But why do you take issue with that particular choice?
Yeah, so, you know, back in 2018, when it was announced that he would be chair of that committee, I wrote an op-ed, you know, dissatisfaction that he was chosen for that. Not for anything particular about him personally. It's just that I don't think he would identify himself as a champion of racial justice. And given how, you know, Democratic Party is moving leftward, and that Maryland prides itself as a progressive state, I thought it would make sense to have someone for whom was intentional about racial justice as a part of their paradigm. Additionally, as I've watched and observed Chairman Klippinger over the past few years, and I list examples of policies that from a racial justice perspective are very clear no-brainers as it relates to addressing issues that impact disproportionately people of African descent, people of color. But what I've noticed is that in both in my conversations with him, just the way that he legislates, that he takes what I describe in that piece as a race neutral approach to these policies. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when you look at, for instance, the youth interrogations bill that I mentioned in there, which simply says that a minor who is stopped by law enforcement, that there's a requirement that if they're being interrogated, that an attorney be present, that their parents are notified. Very straightforward. And you know, as we see, the Ava DuVernay docuseries outlines the way in which the Central Park Five or the Exonerated Five were impacted by that, spent, you know, some of them 10 years in jail. So the point is that a race-conscious, racial justice approach would prioritize a piece of legislation like that going out to protect peoples of African descent who've been impacted by the criminal justice system. And so the argument that I make there is that we need a person to chair that kind of committee that deals with criminal justice, that has an affirmative obligation. Chairman Klippinger, his day job is a prosecutor in Arundel County. And to me, what that says is that he takes a very old school prosecutorial approach to these issues, where it is my belief that a part of how he legislates is what would make it more difficult for him as a prosecutor to get convictions. Which, yeah, again, is the kind of a lens that doesn't really prioritize racial justice.
Davon Love does important work as the director of public policies for policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Davon, always good to talk to you, and look forward to the next time. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Talk soon.
Coming up on the other side of a quick break, the Reverend Kobe Little and Joshua Harris of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. We're talking about the 2021 session of the Maryland General Assembly here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall, continuing now our conversations about what Maryland Speaker of the House Adrian Jones has dubbed the Black Agenda for the 2021 Maryland General Assembly. I'm joined by the Reverend Kobe Little. He is the president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP, and Joshua Harris, who is the NAACP's vice president. Gentlemen, welcome back to you both. And Reverend Little, let me start with you. There is certainly wide consensus about the need for police reform. So I know the NAACP, like Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, support the repeal of the LEOBR. You know, the police commissioner here in Baltimore, Michael Harrison, admits that police reform is necessary. There's a consent decree and you know, other efforts to change the culture of the department and to change the procedures. What do you think needs to be put in place of the LEOBR to reach that goal in a way that, you know, cops on the street are comfortable with?
Tom, thank you for having us on the show again. We have been working in lockstep with the Maryland Coalition for Justice and Police Accountability. Davon is a key leader in that coalition, member of the steering committee, and we're right in lockstep with LBS on the issues of police reform in Maryland. At the end of the day, this issue is bigger than police reform. It's police reform. It speaks directly to our democratic values. It speaks to equality under the law. And as it stands now, policing in the United States is still a direct extension of the slave state that we saw at the beginning of this country. Most of the police laws have their foundation in the Fugitive Slave Act. And until we have positions around policing that are affirmative in the sense that the number one goal is equality under the law, then we're going to have problems. So that's a long way of saying to you that this is not about what makes police officers feel comfortable. This is about upholding the Constitution and making sure, without exception, that every citizen of the United States receives fair treatment from this government and its agents, including law enforcement. And as it stands now, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights is an additional set of rights above and beyond normal personnel protections that are afforded police officers. And it's unacceptable. It allows them to conduct themselves in ways that frankly are above the law.
And Joshua Harris, I think Reverend Little makes a good point that it's not about, you know, the comfort level of police officers. On the other hand, how do you answer those who say that, look, there is an epidemic of murder in the United States that is unfolding at horrific rates? I mean, it's up 75% or 95% in Milwaukee and 78% in Louisville, Kentucky, the town where Breonna Taylor was murdered by police officers. Here in Baltimore, it's actually down slightly. We had fewer murders in the city of Baltimore this year or in 2020 than we did in 2019. But there is a sense that police are standing down and they are not getting involved proactively in the solving of these crimes and the prevention of these crimes in a way that they could have been because they are concerned about backlash. They are concerned about their liability when it comes to their interactions with particularly communities of color. How do you answer the folks who are worried on that side of the spectrum?
Yeah, Tom, that's a great question and very valid concern. But I think there's two key factors that must be known and understood. And number one, all the data shows us that policing is reactionary and not preventative, right? And so when we say and have a concern that police are standing down and not preventing crimes, police officers rarely prevent crime from occurring. We know that making the investment in other agencies, whether it be housing, education, parks and recs, to prevent and deter and address issues of poverty and education, that's what prevents crime, right? And so all the data shows us that, and has consistently for decades now. And secondly, we also have to understand that police officers are charged with enforcing the law. They should be held to not a different standard, but a higher standard of accountability than those who they are enforcing the law upon, because they should know it and be well aware of it. And so they should not have a different set of rules and a different set or of this a bill of rights than the rest of us as citizens, simply because they enforce the law. They should be held to a much higher standard of accountability than everyday citizens, because they are supposed to be trained. They are supposed to be well-versed and know how to deal with the situations that they encounter. And that's something that we just have not seen. And that's why it's critical that we see that the Law Enforcement Office Bill of Rights be removed and repealed. It is about equity. And that has become kind of a slogan word over the last few years. But the reality is that this is about, as Reverend Little stated, us all having equal rights under the law. This is what our Constitution provides. And so there should not be special treatments of police officers. In fact, when they enforce the law, and should know it better than anyone else.
And Reverend Little, are you confident? Are you sanguine about the fact that Speaker Adrian Jones and Bill Ferguson, the Senate President, really have done, it seems, considerably more than anybody has done prior to them in this year when it comes to looking at issues across a broad spectrum of what the legislature is going to deal with through an equity lens? Do you think that the focus of the legislature this year is markedly, demonstrably different? And do you see progress in that regard?
Malcolm X said, if you stick a knife, a 12-inch knife in my back, and you pull it out 6 inches, is that progress? I will say that we certainly are seeing a difference from previous years. And we are hopeful that some of the legislation that is passed this session is equity focused. But there are a number of issues that I want to address around the Black agenda. Davon raised the issues around the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. But before I speak to that, I just wanted to go back to the question around law enforcement officers. This issue of officers choosing not to enforce the law or not to be actively engaged has nothing to do with their fear. It has nothing to do with unfair treatment of police officers. It has everything to do with flexing power and holding the democratic system hostage. And police officers cannot be allowed to hold democracy hostage. And if you think that this point is somewhere far off in outer space, think about this. On January 6th, a police officer was brutally beaten and subsequently passed away. It was outrageous. However, where is the chorus of Blue Lives Matter's voices now? We haven't heard it. And this riotous, anti-democratic, seditious mob murdered a police officer. But we haven't heard anything from them. And so, we've got to challenge the assumptions and reframe the conversation so that we're not playing into the hand of people who are simply trying to maintain a white supremacist, a structurally inequitable system of justice in the United States. Now, as it relates to the legislature and the equity focus, we certainly want to lift up the voices of many of the legislators, including Chairman Will Smith, Senator Jill Carter on the Senate side, Senator Charles Sidnor, and the President Pro Tem, who the Senate President has tapped, and who the Senate President relies on for kind of navigating equity issues. So I can confidently say that President Ferguson is making a strong effort. The state NAACP is in constant dialogue with the president, with his chief of staff and his deputy chief of staff. But I can't say the same necessarily about the speaker's office. I think, you know, the speaker putting forward a black agenda is a great thing. But Tom, I chair the political action committee for the state NAACP. I'm the first vice president. And we haven't heard from the speaker's office. So I don't place that squarely on the speaker's feet, but there's some breakdown there. We've been sending and communicating with the speaker's office and not getting responses. And so you can't really talk about putting forward a black agenda if it's not inclusive of leading organizational of voices. So that's a challenge to the speaker's office to step up in that arena. We're certainly glad to see Speaker Jones as the Speaker of the Maryland General Assembly, but we know that her staff has got to do a better job of connecting and engaging with progressive organizations and with Black-led organizations. It's just, it's just a fact.
Yeah. And Joshua Harris, when it comes to COVID relief efforts, the issue of equity very front and center when it comes to availability of vaccines and availability of testing and other health disparities in the communities of color here in Maryland. What's your focus legislatively going to be in that regard?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's really a great point. I'll allow Reverend Little to chime in here too. Our focus, of course, as the NAACP has really been to make sure that we're doing the work to reach what others would consider hard to reach communities and ensure that they have the information that is necessary for them to protect themselves and stay safe and healthy. And that means they aren't the folks who are necessarily listening to Midday. They aren't watching the governor's press conferences and they aren't necessarily watching CNN to understand what's happening because they're at work every day, sometimes working two and three jobs. They're on public transportation. And so their lives are occupied in other spaces. And so we've been doing work. We've distributed about 20,000 masks over the last 8 months throughout the city. We have our coronavirus mobile health education unit that has been driving across the city with messages that are being sounded off from that truck and that unit from voices that are recognized by those on the ground, informing them to stay home, to wear masks, social distance. We've worked with Baltimore City Schools to try to get messages out about getting technology to students and young people. But on a greater focus, of course, we know that during this pandemic, there's a lot of money that is being spent to provide relief. And so we want to make sure that it isn't being spent with the same old folks and the same individuals, so much so that the NAACP went out of our way to make sure that of the masks that we were distributing, we gave money to local businesses, minority businesses to produce masks for us, right? Because it's an opportunity to ensure that we're doing equity in the distribution of capital. And the state must do the exact same thing. They're spending millions of dollars for relief and making sure that there's transparency in what their minority vendors look like. And I'm sure that Reverend Little wants to speak a little bit more to that, so I'll provide the opportunity for him to respond to that as well.
Yeah, thanks, Reverend Little. We got about a minute left.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to wrap up quickly. Just really proud to work with our Vice President, Josh Harris. He's doing great work. The state has to be able to fight the pandemic and also fight the structural inequity at the same time. And that means that we need transparency. We need to know that when the state spends $1 million on messaging, that that money is being used to tap into the diversity of providers. We need to see the transparency and how the money is spent on the supply chain to roll out the vaccine. And so these are the kind of equity issues that we need to be having conversations with the speaker and the president about so they can be amplifying our voice. The Trump administration is over and the time for lies and politics as it relates to the pandemic is also over. We can't have a governor get on TV and on the one hand chastise people because of their hesitancy around the vaccines and then say that it's safe to reopen schools even without a vaccine. That doesn't make any sense. And so we need leadership to get on the same page. We need an equitable approach that doesn't blame people for the betrayal of their trust, but instead gives them transparency and gives them the information that they need. The NAACP State Conference is focusing on a whole raft of bills this session, ranging from climate and environmental justice to immigration, police accountability, education, certainly consumer rights and housing. A number of labor issues. And so we're going to continue to post these on our social media. You can find us at NAACP MD, or you can find us at NAACP Baltimore.
And we will post a link to both of those sites so that folks can get involved. The Reverend Kobe Little is the president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. Joshua Harris is a former Green Party candidate for mayor here in Baltimore and a vice president of the NAACP. Thanks to you both, and good luck this year in the session. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we turn our attention to Baltimore County. My guest will be County Executive Johnny Olszewski, Jr. Stay tuned now for Future City with our good friend Wes Moore. That's coming up at the top of the hour after news. And tonight, be sure to download The Daily Dose. That's WYPR's podcast of all the local news that we're covering for you here at Your Public Radio. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.